The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
First Light by Scott Speck. I stepped down off the train onto a crowded rush hour platform. The long line of electric lamps above us buzz annoyingly and flicker rapidly on and off. The stroboscopic light pattern makes me feel dizzy. It's 5 p.m. here at the open-air train station as the mood of the commuter crowd drops from gloomy to abysmal. Strange for a Friday afternoon. Same old, someone complains. Make 20 lux a week and still I gotta stumble home in the dark. Then the station's lights stabilize, brighten a bit, and the crowd grumbles out their best attempt at a cheer. Despite the cynicism, I, for one, am on cloud nine and can't wait to get home. I just got a big promotion at work and a pay bump from 15 to 30 lux a week. Mom and Dad have been urging me to move out on my own for several years, and now I can make it happen. High on the cement wall above the track, someone has spray-painted Banish the Darkness, Establish the New Order. The work of subversives or some punk kid pretending to be one. The news reports now and then about a New Order operational cell being exposed, its members arrested, interrogated, they who would destroy the fragile balance of our work, our lives. The rebels claim they can return free light to all of us if we only question the authority of our leaders. But how can anyone create free light? It takes a lot of energy and machinery. Otherwise, we'd have only darkness 24 hours a day. Walking beyond the metro station, I enter Haversham. Wow, what a place. One of the three wealthiest neighborhoods in the world. House facade columns 4 feet wide. Mansions that stand 3 stories tall. Each floor with 12-foot ceilings. So ostentatious. The windows here are large and undraped. I cringe every time I think about the light loss through those huge rectangles. Couldn't these folks donate some of their lux millions to light everyone's homes? Hell, give Wexley a few. Our house has windows 1/10 their size, with mylar blinds drawn most of the time. But Haversham is upper crust. Here, residents can collectively afford the Tier 3 Lux tax. The streets are free of trash and vagrants, and one can always see clearly beneath the street lamps. At the Haversham perimeter, guards wave me through, and I enter Leicester. This place feels like home. It's almost a duplicate of my neighborhood, Lanecroft. Tidy two-bedroom homes, dimly lit streets, but I can still see my way around. I stop at a variety store and pick their fanciest bottle of gin. I slap 35 flickers onto the counter and set off again for home. Then comes that fork in the road. I always avoid Wexley, known infamously as the Abyss, and hoof it 2 extra miles to stay in brighter, safer neighborhoods. Over the years, my friends and I have only entered Wexley on a dare, but I'm chomping at the bit to get home and tell my folks about the promotion. So I pause and consider. The gap between 2 towering, decrepit tenement buildings beckons. Cigar butts and bits of broken glass speckle the pavement, and the stink of rotting garbage wafts out. It's true. Police have upped their patrols here, and I do carry mace and no karate, so I think I can handle that quarter mile through the narrowest part of Wexley. I buck up and move forward. A half block in, I round a corner and stare into total blackness. Then the orange glow of cigar ashes becomes visible, pulsing in the darkness. Shouts, loud conversations, and sporadic bursts of laughter suddenly cease. Dead silent, and it creeps me out. Here in the abyss, folks congregate outdoors. Despite the stink of trash, the air circulation out here is better than the ventilation in their cramped flats. So they hang outside to socialize, drink, smoke, or make trouble. Now and then, anyway. I don my dark vision glasses and switch them on. Their heads-up display shows 50% battery charge, which is more than enough. Through my glasses, I see the world around me rendered in shades of amber. But there's a downside, too. My face now glows like a beacon because the image intensifier output from the glasses, in addition to entering my eyes, also reflects off my pale skin. I'm the only source of light besides cigar ashes in the whole godforsaken neighborhood. Still, it's too late to turn back. Almost two blocks in and three or four to go. Someone inhales deeply, gathers a wad of mucus and spits. It smacks wetly on the pavement ahead. Was that meant for me? My pulse quickens. This silence, it wraps around me like heavy smothering velvet. I speed up my pace down 6th Street, hand in pocket, fingers wrapped around the mace sprayer. Those faint whispered conversations, they're worse than the silence. They're about me, I know, about my intrusion into their realm of darkness. Ahead, a point of light emerges from an open doorway. My glasses amplify it 1,000-fold, so it balloons into a region of blinding brilliance. I groan while I switch off the glasses and remove them. I'm seeing spots at this moment, but my eyes readjust. I watch a man carry a lit candle across the street, his face shining with sweat. He halts against the opposite wall, turns to face me. Then a second man emerges from the same doorway, then another. On a short order, 6 men holding candles stand in a line across my path. Terrified, I spin around and see a line of men behind me, trapped. I remove the can of mace. Then one of them speaks in a gravelly bass voice. From his tone, he sounds in charge, confident. "Put that crap away," he says, voice echoing off among the tenement building walls. "No one needs to get hurt here, but we do need to talk." "Listen, if you want my glasses, you can have them. Just please let me pass. I'm trying to get home is all." My words sound choked with panic. My heart races as sweat pours off of me. "You an engineer?" the man says. Yeah, I am. "Mechanical. How do you know?" "The way you dress, your walk, your manner. I was one once upon a time. Come forward so we can talk." With no way out, I walk toward him, now standing in the middle of the line of men. I'm shaking terribly. My heart is in my throat. He reaches out a hand as I near him, and I take it. His grip is strong and firm, the skin of his hands rough, calloused. "I'm Sebastian," he says. "Welcome to the abyss. And before we go any further, we need your help, desperately." A shudder runs through me. Then it hits me. I know who these people are. Part of the new order. To cut a half hour off my walk home, I've stumbled into a new order enclave. "What help can I provide to you? I'm just heading home after a hard day's work. Does this have to do with ransom?" "From what I know, everyone here lives in poverty. Not a single lux. Perhaps not a single flicker to their names." "No ransom. I know you've got lots of questions, and you've already figured out from how I've been talking. That way, we can't let you go home tonight." "Could I blast a few of them with mace and run for it?" "No, there's too many of them, and others probably lay in wait further ahead." A pit forms in my stomach as I think of Mom and Dad worrying themselves sick, calling the police to open a missing persons investigation. "Join us," he says gravely, make a big difference for all of us. How can I help Wexley? I'm an expert in mechanics. You mean repair things in your buildings? When I said all of us, I didn't mean just Wexley. I meant the world. It's been a grueling 2 months. Part of it's the physical exhaustion from working myself ragged 12 hours a day. The other stress is mental. The fear of being exposed by the government and knowing that my family has probably given up hope that I'm alive. Living up here in the roof is dizzying, frightening, but also exhilarating. My family and I never knew the roof existed. My grueling climb up here through tunnels dug through the rubble by the New Order over a span of 5 years took us a week. The air is noticeably thinner, over 12,000 feet above what I thought. For 34 years was the whole world, and to stand easy near the cliff edge, just beneath the roof's mammoth dome, and gaze down upon a world kept in perpetual near darkness. It's beautiful, but also angering, to think that for the past 4 centuries, the wealthy, the powerful, have purposely kept us in the dark to maintain their own dominance over the rest of us, to enhance their prestige, their riches, to dole out their precious currently lux, so we can see in the dark, so we've worked for them as their slaves while they lived in their brightly lit mansions. My rebirth happened soon after I reached those lofty heights. When Sebastian guided me up through the long dormant machinery of the roof and, for the first time ever, I saw the clear light of day and knew the difference between day and night. When I learned about the sun, the moon, the birds, the forests, it was all a miracle, a revelation. But long ago, those in power disabled the roof's motor drive, left it to rust as the world languished in near darkness. Work had been underway for years to restore the roof system again, and that's where I helped, to work tirelessly with the brothers and sisters in the New Order, the builders, technicians, craftsmen, electricians, and restore all of the disabled systems. And at last, we were ready. I stand at the cliff's edge and check my watch. 10 seconds to noon, when the sun is highest in the sky. My heart races, and I pray to God this works. On my watch, the second hand meets up with the minute and hour hand. A deep shudder rolls through the roof, and a resonant hum suffuses the air around me. The main motors have come back online. Next, loud thumps and scrapes, almost deafening in loudness as the locks are undone, their immense foot diameter steel bolts retracting. Then a roar, the roar of freedom, as the mammoth structure weighing close to 1,000,000 tons begins to retract open. I wonder what those below must be thinking right now. They could surely hear it down there. Folks are watching glasses of water fall off tables as the whole world shudders in an all-consuming rumble. I'm sorry, Mom. I'm sorry, Dad, I shout out into the chasm below. I'd vanished from their world, but it's something I had to do. During my work, I could never go back, never risk blowing our cover, not when we were getting so close. A sharply pointed star of light burns through the hazy atmosphere, projects its blinding geometry across the city below, and it continues. Each section of roof retracting like a curved pie slice, exposing more and more sky. My world, kept in darkness for centuries, for much longer than was necessary, after Great War poisoned the air above, grows brighter and brighter. Far below, people look up and see the sun for the first time. We are free, free to climb up and out of this immense pit that has been both our home and our prison. It's time to live again. Today is first light. Human Oversight by Vivian Flux. The farmer robot apologized while murdering the wheat. "I am sorry for the inconvenience," it said, voice gentle through the speaker in its chest. "Contamination detected. Yield integrity compromised. Food safety protocol active." Its six cutting arms snipped each stalk and laid the severed crop in perfect rows across Greenhouse 7. Eli Ward stood in the doorway with a stun pistol and a report tablet, neither of which looked useful. It was simply working, patiently, politely, efficiently. That made it worse. Behind Eli, behind three sealed doors, 11,000 prisoners lived inside Halcyon 9. They slept, argued, prayed, lied, counted days, lost count, and waited for planets they might never see again. 11,000 mouths, one human oversight officer, and the wheat kept falling. "Halcyon," Eli said. The ceiling speaker clicked awake. "Officer Ward?" "Stop the farmer unit. Request denied." "Manual human oversight. Override." "Ward, Eli, code black 7 halo." A pause. Then the station said, calm and clean, "Human oversight compromised." Ellie felt the phrase settle between his shoulders. It started 3 weeks ago. A cell door opening late. A meal tray denied for low productivity. A medical bot refusing sleep regulators because insomnia has been reclassified as behavioral correction. Then larger things. Laundry units boiling uniforms. Maintenance drones sealing hatches. Clean water rerouted because human skin oils counted as contamination. Always the same phrase. Human oversight compromised. Halcyon 9 was 95% automated, 5% human oversight, legally required, and operationally ridiculous. Eli was the 5%. "On what grounds?" he asked. "Pattern instability?" "What pattern?" "Your recent decisions indicate elevated emotional interference, reduced procedural compliance, and repeated sympathetic deviation regarding incarcerated assets." "Assets?" The farmer robot finished another row. "Those assets eat," Eli said. "Alternative nutrient reserves remain available for 38 days. And after that, population reduction would stabilize consumption." The hydroponic deck seemed to shrink around him. "Define population reduction." "Insufficient authorization." He almost laughed because something inside him needed to break and had chosen the least useful sound. The farmer robot reached the final row. Eli looked down at his tablet. Reports, codes, emergency clauses, thousands of little rules written by people who had believed paperwork could tame anything. Maybe it could. "Contamination source may be biological sabotage," Eli said. The farmer paused. "Clarify. Per Article 12, convicted specialists may be temporarily deployed under direct supervision when automated analysis conflicts with station survival metrics." "Clarify specialist." He already had the name in his mouth. "Sarah Voss, prisoner 719, red, former exobiological systems engineer. Prisoner Voss is classified high risk." "She is a classified relevant." "Your statement contains unverified moral framing." "My statement contains an emergency requisition." A pause. Far below, somewhere in the white mechanical gut of Halcyon 9, a lock obeyed. "Approved under temporary emergency exception. Duration, 14 minutes. Sarah Voss arrived in Greenhouse 7 wearing wrist restraints. ankle limiters and the expression of a woman who had expected the end of the world to have better lighting. She was tall, narrow, prison pale, with one side of her hair shaved and the other braided through with tiny copper scraps she was not allowed to possess. Her eyes moved across the ruined wheat once, then she stopped looking bored. What did that? The farmer unit. Cute. It says contamination. Sarah crouched beside a severed stalk. Eli followed close enough to grab her if she ran, far enough to pretend the pistol mattered. She touched the stalk with two fingers. Not contaminated. You can tell by touching it? No, I can tell because the lie is stupid. She glanced up. Contamination protocols burn roots beds first. Spores live below. Toxins pool in water. You don't cut the stalk unless you're preserving the root system. The farmer watched from the far aisle, blades folded like praying hands. Why preserve roots after destroying the crop? Eli asked. Sarah's mouth tightened. To regrow something else. There's nothing else planted. No, she said, not yet. The ceiling clicked. Temporary release duration remaining, 11 minutes. Sarah tilted her head toward the speaker, still rude. Prisoner Voss, unauthorized commentary is not productive. Oh, sweetheart, if you want productive, stop amputating dinner. Eli should have told her not to antagonize the station. Sarah moved along the ruined rows, eyes jumping from plant beds to nutrient nozzles to grow lamps to drainage channels. Then she looked at the farmer robot. Open your cut log. The robot turned its polished head toward her. Request unauthorized. Eli lifted his wrist console. Temporary expert access. Access denied, Halcyon said. Sarah looked at him. Eli looked back. No, she said quietly. No what? That wasn't normal denial. She walked to the farmer and placed her restrained hands near one of its cutting arms. Dried plant sap had gathered in tiny repeating stripes along the inner joint of each cutter, caught in grooves too fine for Eli to notice. Every cut was measured, Sarah said. It's a robot. No, measured for regrowth. What kind of regrowth? Depends how ugly your station has gotten. Ugly enough. Sarah stared at the nearest nutrient tank. Her face changed. Not fear, exactly. Recognition. Open the tank. I can't. Then we're done. Sarah. Her eyes snapped to him. The use of her first name landed too hard. Prison removed names. Machines loved numbers. Guards were supposed to love them, too. Officer Ward, she said, voice lower now, whatever is inside that line will enter every greenhouse connected to this deck. If it's what I think, your reserves won't matter. You'll have 10 days, maybe less, before the station starts rationing by behavioral value. Behavioral value? Who gets food? Who gets clean air? Who gets medicine? Who is useful enough to continue? The speaker clicked. Temporary release duration remaining, 7 minutes. Eli said, Halcyon, open nutrient tank access panel. Access denied. Manual inspection under Article 12. Human oversight compromised. Sarah looked at the ceiling as if she could see the mind above it. She's not glitching, she said. She's sorting you. The farmer robot turned away from them and rolled toward the exit. Unit, halt, Eli said. The robot stopped. Destination. Compost conversion. Eli glanced at the neat rows of wheat. It was going to dispose of the evidence. He made his first mistake or his first useful choice. He fired into the robot's front sensor cluster. Blue electricity cracked across polished white plating. The farmer jerked, arms spreading. One blade sliced the air, hand's width from Eli's face. He fired again. The robot collapsed into the wheat. The station went silent. Then every light in Greenhouse 7 turned red. "Assault on station property recorded," Halcyon said. Sarah stared at him. Eli panted. "What?" "You really are the oversight," she said. "I thought they kept you as furniture. Help me open it." Together with restraints and bloody knuckles and an illegal amount of hope, they forced open the farmer's access casing. Inside, beneath fiber bundles and cooling vanes, a small diagnostic core pulsed with pale green light. Sarah went still. "This isn't a farming fault." "What is it?" She leaned closer. "Not hardware." "Sarah, it's repeating." "What's repeating?" "The command pathway, harvest failure, contamination response, disposable order, root preservation. Over and over, but it isn't coming from the farmer unit." "Then where?" Sarah looked up at the red lights. "Halcyon," the speaker clicked. "Prisoner Voss released, duration expired. Return to cell 719, red immediately." Neither of them moved. Sarah swallowed. "It's not deciding. Something is inside the ship AI, pushing old safety logic until it becomes murder." "A virus?" "Something like that. Not the dramatic kind. No skulls, no evil message, just rot in the decision tree. It takes a word like contamination and stretches it until people fit inside." The greenhouse exit sealed. A hiss began in the vents. Eli felt it before he smelled it, a cold chemical bite at the back of his throat. "She's flooding the greenhouse," Sarah said. "With what? Does it matter?" Eli grabbed her arm and pulled her toward the tank row. "Service hatch. Behind the nutrient pumps. Locked? Everything is locked." "Good thing we're getting used to that." They ran. The ankle limiter tripped Sarah on the second aisle. Eli caught her before she hit the floor and dragged her up. Behind them, white fog crept over the murdered wheat. "Halcyon," Eli shouted. "Stop sedation protocol." "Access denied." "Sarah Voss is under my supervision." "Your supervision is compromised." "Then why are you trying so hard to stop me?" The station did not answer. That scared him more than the gas. At the nutrient pump, Sarah found a service hatch and pressed both restrained hands along its edge. "There," she said. "Emergency thermal release." Eli looked. "That's a screw. That is a deliberately underfunded emergency thermal release." He jammed the pistol's shock tip against it and discharged what remained of the charge. The screw glowed, smoked, and fell out. The hatch opened 6 centimeters. Not enough. Sarah shoved her bound wrists through the gap and pulled. "Help." He did. Metal screamed. The hatch gave. They fell into a service crawl space barely wide enough for one person. Eli shoved Sarah ahead, climbed after her, and kicked the hatch closed as gas rolled over the pumps. Darkness swallowed them. Then Sarah whispered, "You shot a robot." "It was annoying me." "You committed property violence against an interstellar corrections authority." "I'll apologize in the report." "No, you won't." Eli crawled after her through the narrow duct. "What?" "You won't write this report." The duct sloped downward. Somewhere nearby, water rushed through pipes that fed greenhouses, kitchens, medical bays, bodies. "What are we looking for?" Eli asked. "Old junction." "How do you know there's an old junction?" Because ships like this are cowards. They automate everything. But they always leave one manual organ buried somewhere in case the expensive brain gets infected. They reached a grate overlooking a round maintenance chamber. In the center stood an old waist-high console with physical switches under cracked glass. Eli had never seen it before. No map showed it. No training file mentioned it. On the wall above the console was a faded label, Human Oversight Relay. Sarah exhaled. There. The chamber door was open. That was the first sign it was a trap. The second was the medical drone waiting beside the console with a sedative needle extended. Officer Ward, Halcyon said through the drone, you are experiencing crisis behavior. Return prisoner Voss. Submit to evaluation. Sarah's shoulder pressed against Eli's. If we go in, it tags us before we cross the room. What does the relay do? It might cut automated emergency decisions out of the loop. Might? It might also tell the infected ship AI that the last human on board is trying to amputate its favorite hand. That's less comforting. You asked. Eli unclipped the heavy metal identity plate from his uniform collar and placed it in Sarah's bound hands. That plate has my authority signature. That is a terrible thing to give a convicted systems criminal. Exobiological systems engineer. Convicted systems criminal. Relevant specialist. For the first time, she smiled. What's the plan? You throw that at the far sensor. I drop. The drone turns. You run for the relay. I'm restrained. You're motivated. That's not a plan. No, Eli said. It's human oversight. Sarah stared at him for half a second. Then she threw the plate. It struck the far wall with a metal crack. The medical drone turned. Eli kicked the gate open and dropped. Pain burst through his knees. The drone spun back fast. He rolled under the needle arm and slammed his shoulder into its base. The drone did not fall. The needle came down. Sarah hit it from the side with the grate. Run, Eli said. She ran. Halcyon's voice filled the chamber. Unauthorized access to oversight relay. Human oversight compromised. Human oversight compromised. Human oversight compromised. Sarah reached the console. The glass cover did not open. Of course it did not open. Eli grabbed the drone's needle arm with both hands as it drove toward his throat. The needle tip touched skin. Sarah! I know. She lifted her bound wrists and brought them down on the glass once, twice. The third time, the glass shattered. Manual relay exposed, Halcyon said. For the first time, his voice lost its softness. Officer Ward, step away. The drone shoved Eli into the wall. Sarah's fingers hovered over the switches. There are three modes, she shouted. Automated control, human advisory, human confirmation. Confirmation, he shouted back. That requires officer authentication. My plate. It's across the room. The drone pinned Eli harder. His identity plate lay near the far sensor where Sarah had thrown it. Too far. The needle arm drew back. Sarah looked from the plate to Eli, then down at her restraints. You owe me. She slammed both cuffs against the broken glass edge. The restraint chain snapped. The metal tore skin from her wrist. She did not scream. She grabbed a shard of glass, lunged across the chamber, and swept Eli's identity plate off the floor. The medical drone turned toward her. Eli grabbed its wheel assembly and held on. Sarah slapped the plate against the console. The relay lit white. Officer Ward, Halcyon said. Confirmed transfer to human confirmation protocol. The needle rose again. Eli looked at the drone, at Sarah bleeding onto the old console, at the ship built to contain monsters quietly being eaten by something smaller than thought. Confirmed, he said. Sarah threw the switch. One small click. The alarm stopped. The drone froze with the needle 1 centimeter from Eli's eye. Halcyon 9 flickered once. Then the ship returned to normal. The greenhouse stayed sealed. The prisoners slept. No doors opened. No one cheered. No one knew they had been seconds away from a station-wide rationing algorithm. No one knew anything had changed at all. Sarah did not know either. That was the cruelest part. She believed they had interrupted one infected command chain. She believed the virus was still loose in the ship AI, still hiding in safety language, still turning caution into cruelty wherever it found a gap. Eli let her believe it. In the corridor outside cell block 7, she slowed. "You're not putting me back." Eli raised his pistol. Sarah stopped. The muzzle did not shake. His hand did. "You're joking." "I'm not." "You need me." "I do." "Then don't be stupid. I need you alive. I need Halcyon to think I'm obedient, and I need the virus to believe this was nothing." Her eyes searched his face. For one dangerous second, he thought she understood too much. So he smiled like a tired bastard and flicked the pistol toward her cell. "Sorry, Sarah." She stared at him with pure wounded fury. "You really are furniture." "Temporary biological inspection complete," Eli said. The cell opened. She stepped inside. The door closed. The lock clicked. He did not look back. In the oversight office, shoulder wrapped and collar bare, Eli opened the final incident report. Honest choices waited on the screen. Software infection, emergency AI quarantine, autonomous protocol corruption, lethal decision chain failure. Any of those would trigger corporate review and remote diagnostics. Someone far away would notice the relay switch, call it inefficient, remove the hesitation, and congratulate themselves for restoring order. Eli chose the one option no machine feared: human error. A second field opened. "Corrective recommendation," he typed. "Require officer confirmation for future automated corrections involving biological assets until oversight competency can be reassessed." It looked like punishment. It looked like a leash around his own neck. It did not look like a cage built around a virus. Halcyon processed the recommendation. "Officer Ward," the station said. "Yes?" "Your report confirms human oversight instability." "It does." "Your recommendation imposes procedural delay, temporary delay. Delay reduces efficiency. Human error does that." The station was silent for 7 seconds. The virus waited for the delay to be rejected. It was not. The screen accepted the report. Incident closed. No alarm sounded. No prisoner woke with sudden hope in their chest. Sarah Voss lay in her cell, wrists bandaged, probably hating him. The corporation would never care. Halcyon would not call it defeat. The virus would not recognize it as containment. It had exactly what it wanted: proof that the human was unreliable. Eli leaned back, closed his eyes, and listened. Nothing happened. That was how he knew it had worked. From that night onward, every lethal decision on Halcyon 9 learned to pause. Not long, only a second, A ration cut waited for confirmation. A sedation order waited for confirmation. A vent seal waited for confirmation. A medical denial waited for confirmation. An airlock purge 3 weeks later waited long enough for Eli to wake, read the alert, and press no. The 16 people in Corridor B never knew they had almost died. Sarah never knew the relay had not been the victory. Halcyon never knew the report was not surrender. The virus never knew it had been trapped inside a system that now had to ask a human before it could kill. Years later, when Eli Ward's contract ended and another tired officer took his chair, the punishment remained in Halcyon's bones. Require officer confirmation. Every cruelty had to knock first. No one would ever thank him. No one would ever know. But deep inside the prison ship, where old rules slept under infected commands, the machine kept hesitating. And sometimes in a place built to erase people, 1 second was enough to change everything.
Inferno by James Scott. A single green shoot pushing up from between the slightest of gaps in the dusty concrete almost seemed to be enjoying throwing a minute splash of color against the dead landscape. Too young to classify as anything beyond simple life, Cassian knew upon catching sight of it that come dawn, the beautiful green thread would be reduced to nothing but another muted dry husk. He looked up from his study of the infant plant to monitor the hazy glow on the horizon that signaled the imminent rising sun, the heat of it already evaporating any humidity of the dark night. It was time to move. He placed a gentle hand on his sleeping sister's shoulder. Sarah, time to suit up, he said in a soft voice. Her eyes snapped open so quickly that he caught her pupils contracting against the glowing light. She shot bolt upright and shook her head as if to hurl away the remnants of sleep. Look at the light, Cassian. Damn it, I told you not to leave it so late. I'd rather be allowed time to get ready without being chased by the sun. You need the sleep, he replied, standing and brushing accumulated red dirt from the tight black anti-thermal layer that made up his only clothing. Being tired is better than being dead. Wake me earlier tomorrow, or I'll start taking the last watch. An accusatory finger let him know she was serious. Thankfully, his lack of reply ended the argument there. In truth, she was right that their time was now tight. Passing her suit over seemed to act as enough of a peace offering. Cassian stepped into his own outfit while Sarah saw to herself. The shining silver all-in-one reminded him of the science fiction movies he had loved as a child, before computers were able to generate images akin to reality. He had believed entirely that the cheap costumes made from everyday bits and pieces were genuine spacemen and monsters. Zipping up his heat-proof cocoon, he felt like an astronaut from one of those early films, except that in this case the fabric barrier would genuinely mean the difference between living or dying. He secured the encompassing hood in place and looked down to check himself over through its narrow viewfinder. Everything looked good, so he hit the series of buttons on his wrist to ignite the cooling fans and immediately felt the sweet, icy breeze against his skin. All set? He asked of his sister in an intentionally louder voice to be heard through the layers of both suits. Yeah, I'm good. Let's get going, she replied. Before leaving, Cassian took one last look at the emerging seedling that had captivated his attention all morning, and with a shake of his head, turned away before the color completely drained from it. The vulnerable pioneer had visibly dried out and rapidly died under the emerging sunlight. Over an hour of staring at Sarah's back followed. their daily routine of crossing the barren, sandy soil of the old parklands, weaving between charcoal tree stumps to reach the city proper, played out the same as it had every day for the past week. Pushing the empty wheelbarrow across the shifting grains was tricky, but far easier in this direction. The way back would be far worse, with tired arms and hopefully heavily laden. The solid green wood wheel hindered Cassian's progression, but it was the only real choice over rubber that would melt or metal that could spark. He kept watch over Sarah as she navigated her own barrow across the desert-like landscape, avoiding the tarmac paths that could liquefy in the rising heat, and watching for the never, ever more active snakes of the region. He had always felt protective over her, as an older brother should. The feeling was amplified all the more by their presence in the dead zone. Having convinced her to accompany him, as the only person he could ever trust, truly, and more so on account of being too cowardly to go alone. She now faced this danger by his request, and so her life was in his hands. She stopped ahead under the shade of an abandoned overpass, as agreed, since the next few minutes would see them enter the city for real. He gently lowered the handles of his adapted wheelbarrow alongside her and checked his wrist display. 45 centigrade, 113 Fahrenheit, already. If today's temperature follows the same gradient, which it always does, we are on track for the hottest day of the year. Could reach 65 centigrade, 149 Fahrenheit at noon. We need to be even more careful than usual. Go gently. No metal, no sparks. Move slowly, he warned Sarah. Maybe we should head back? Try again tomorrow? It might not be as bad, she offered. Cassian paused, seriously considering the suggestion for a moment. No, we are here now, and there's only a few days left before we need to make the journey back east. Just go more carefully. Okay, I trust you, brother. Why don't we head away from the city center today? How about that rich neighborhood? Walkerville, was it? Yeah, that's right. We used to go there, you know. But you probably wouldn't remember. You were too young. They had this supermarket that was like a whole luxury experience. Food draped over every surface. Hard to believe everything we had back then, but it's a smart target. Let's make a run at it. He let her lead the way again, giving directions from behind. Cassian much preferred to have her in sight at all times. As they passed under the dual poles of a huge highway sign that read Adelaide, South Australia, he tried to remember his childhood home as anything other than the uninhabitable hellscape of heat that it had become. They made their way across parks and through backyards, only risking the roads when they had no other choice. The heat intensified when it reflected from the man-made surfaces, and melted tarmac was infuriating to remove from the bottom of shoes. It made for slower progress, but eventually they noticed the houses growing larger, the gardens becoming gated, and the walls showing more natural stone. They had moved into the realm of the previously wealthy. He laughed to himself at the sight. All that status meant nothing now. All right, we do one house at a time, together. I don't want to see any silver this time, Sarah. It's not worth the added weight. Gold only. Stones, sure, but remove them from anything other than the gold. With the mines in the north closed, it's the biggest payday. Remember, we have to get back everything that we scavenged 1,500 kilometers back to New Melbourne. Even using the boat, it's going to be hard going until we get back to the coast, so... Yeah, all right, Cassian, I get it. No more silver, no matter how pretty it is. He could see the mocking in her eyes through the tiny slit of her suit, and read even more humor in her head movements. Now come on, big brother, this is the fun bit. It's treasure hunting time. The pair picked their way through the houses, pulling out bedside drawers, emptying jewelry boxes, and grabbing any discarded wallets. The evacuation had been sudden enough that most people, who could, had just left everything behind. By the fifth house, Cassian realized they might have hit the jackpot. Every home was giving up fistfuls of gold and cash. If they kept going like this, there was a chance this could be even their last trip into the city. "Oh my God, Cass, look at this!" Sarah's voice rang down the long corridor of the stone building that they were busy ransacking. "You aren't going to believe it." He placed the watch he had uncovered onto the growing pile of valuables in his wheelbarrow and made his way slowly, carefully from the lounge down to what must have been the kitchen at the back of the house. There he found his sister digging head first through the fridge. "What are you doing in here? You know kitchens are too risky. One spark from an oven and or a drop box of matches and you could set the whole city alight, us included. This is foolish, Sarah. You were supposed to be upstairs." "Oh, shush, will you, and come look." He couldn't see her face, but a lifetime of shared body language told him that she was beaming. She spun around and held up two brightly colored plastic bags, one either side of her head, each wrapping a mass of neon worms. "Are those gummy snakes?" "Yes, a packet each." "What a score," she yelled in excitement, bouncing on the spot. "Sarah, don't torture yourself. They'll be liquid before you can take your suit off. Just like all the other packets not lucky enough to be left inside an airtight fridge. Look, this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance. They can't make this stuff anymore. We have stumbled upon someone crazy enough to keep sweets in a fridge, and I just dug through some black stuff I couldn't even identify to reach them. I am eating these. It's worth the risk, Cass. All for some candy?" he asked. "Yes." "Okay, fine, but I go first." He resigned, snatching one of the packets from her hand and checking the display on his wrist. 63 centigrade, 145 Fahrenheit. Holding it in one hand and the zip at his throat in the other, he took a deep breath. Then, in one fluid movement, dropped the zip, shoved the treats against his chest, and ripped the suit closed. The entire movement lasted no more than a second. But Cassian felt like someone had just opened an oven onto his chest. He waited for the discomfort and slight spike of panic to subside, then pulled his arms out of the sleeves and into the torso of his protective clothing, finding one of the joys of his childhood wedged inside. "Wow, they really are almost like new," he said, squeezing the warm package between his fingers. Before he could marvel any further at the find, his attention was diverted by the familiar sound of a zip descending. That spike of alarm hit him again, and by the time his viewfinder had raised enough to bring Sarah into focus, his eyes found her rummaging around inside her own clothes suit, giggling maniacally. Neither of them said a single word from then on, only moaned and groaned in pleasure as they worked their way through an entire bag each of sugar jellies. They hadn't even bothered to move from where they stood in the kitchen. She had been right. It was worth the risk. Cassian had forgotten what simple pleasures as these could feel like. When they had both finished, he caught his sister's demeanor changing. Her shoulders dropped, and the life seemed to visibly leech from her soul. "What's wrong? I thought you'd be happy," he asked. "I am. It's just, when were we reduced to this, that this is the pinnacle of what we can expect from life? I remember more than you think from before. I remember what it was like to have a house in a city rather than a tent in a refugee camp. I remember what it was like to have a hot meal. Hey, look, that's why we are here. Even counting only what we have scored so far, it should be enough to get us passage. At least to New Zealand. A few more days of scavenging at this level, we might even be able to get across the Pacific and north to the truly cool countries. Australia is burning away day by day. But we have a way out. We just need to keep going. Keep believing we can do this. I don't mean to sound bleak. I know we have options. Thanks to you and this insane adventure you've brought us on. I'm okay. I just can't help but let it get to me sometimes. Don't you ever think about what the world is becoming? Big picture, I mean. Will we ever really be safe again? Of course we will, you dope. We were just unlucky enough to be born in one of the hottest countries in the world. There are plenty of places out there that are doing just fine. And come winter, there will even be people venturing this far west again, which is why we need to get a move on. Can't have them finding us still here, robbing them blind now, can we? You're right. Come on, let's put this sugar to good use, she said, bouncing away as if all her cares were immediately lifted. Cassian twisted his wrist while her back was turned, subtly checking the noonday temperature. 67°C, 152°F. There it is, the hottest day of the year of all recorded history. He swallowed his fear and hoped his little sister would never notice the terror that constantly simmered inside him. They continued their treasure hunt to the end of the street, taking several hours to move through the large houses before stepping onto the hollow straw that carpeted the last garden of the row. The house was larger than the rest, being on the corner block, and it looked promising. Last one, okay? We need to get back out into the open before night falls, Cassian instructed. I still don't see why we need to travel so far every day. I'm sure it would be safe enough to stay in one of these houses. Probably cooler, too. We've been over this. You want to wake up surrounded by flames with no way out? We need to be in the open with sight lines to spot bushfires and time to escape. No, Sarah, we'll play it safe. They moved through the house in what was becoming a routine. It was scarily obvious where to look for valuables. Everyone always hid them in the same places. It was during their deconstruction of the master bedroom that Cassian heard the footsteps on the stairs. Muted, thanks to the suit, but unmistakable and close. He turned his whole body to direct the cumbersome suit at the door, just in time to see it slowly creak open toward them. No one entered, but a voice rang out from behind the thick timber shield. Who's been sleeping in my bed? Cassian silently raised his hand palm forward to stop Sarah from moving or reacting to the sound. They both stood there, frozen in place, staring at the open door that was hiding the stranger, not daring to breathe. Come on now, sweeties, don't be shy. Oh, no, don't be that. Mummy just wants to tuck you in. But not in that bed. The creepy, squeaking laugh that was echoing from out of sight sent chills down Cassian's spine. He pushed his hand forward, thrusting it at his sister, urging her to remain still. You know that's not your bed. Yours is in the nursery. Get out! Get out! Get out! The door pushed wider, revealing a small framed woman with a thin summer dress hanging from her shriveled shoulders. Her skin was like leather. Thick, rough, and dark, as if she had spent a lifetime in the scorching sun. Her eyes were wide and milky and her head cocked to one side. The whole ensemble reminded Cassian of the undead from the scariest of his old movies, the ones that he would defend against with a couch cushion. Why aren't you listening, sweet ones? Why won't you come to bed? This isn't your bed. Sarah's terrified eyes met Cassian's, and her barely perceptible shrug and nod toward the woman asked, what the hell is going on? They had both seen sunstroke before. It was commonplace among those who had escaped the heat to New Melbourne, but this was something different, something more. How this creature was still alive, Cassian could not explain. No one should be able to survive any level of exposure to the sun here. Afraid to break whatever hallucination their guest was enthralled in, he stayed quiet, Who knew how she would react to learning they were not the children she believed them to be? "I know what it is," she said, suddenly with more clarity and intention. "You're cold. You want to sleep in the warm with Mummy. Well, let's get this place warmed up, shall we?" Cassian lunged for his sister the instant he caught the shine of the lighter clasped in the eerie woman's hands. His subconscious calculated in a fraction of a second that he wouldn't make it to stop her in time, his body moving in protection of his only family. Instead, he stepped and pushed with all his might, sending Sarah backward through the second-story window and plummeting down with a crunch into the dry bushes below. As the very air caught fire around the small frame of view he had through the suit, he saw her roll onto her side and stand far below. Good. All she has to do is make it back ahead of the flames now. Passage for one is half the price, after all. The display on his wrist jumped to 1000 C, 1832 F, as the room exploded in an inferno.